Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 147. It's Monday, January 17th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID is still raging. The Omicron is having its way with us. And COVID-19 is now, again, the number one cause of death in the United States. And likely it will remain so for weeks. Okay, well, of course, the big story now is you can hardly follow cases because we're kind of got a broken testing system. So we're kind of maxing out on the number of tests we can even do, so we can't even identify most of the positives that are actually out there. So we really have to look to hospitals. But of course, even then, we're starting to max out. We've already reached record levels of hospitalizations for the pandemic, and hospital capacity is really being stretched. Some folks actually worry quite a bit about healthcare workers that are lost by having vaccine mandates, which of course is well under 1% of healthcare workers that have been fired because they won't comply with a vaccine mandate. But that pales in comparison to the hospital capacity that's lost by losing healthcare workers due to stress and moral injury as part of the, quote, great resignation that's happening across not only healthcare but across our society. Well, hospital capacity is getting to the point that beds can't be liberated because there aren't enough workers in rehab centers or nursing homes to release them to, so they kind of get backed up in the hospital. Workers in ambulatory and primary care centers are also being temporarily moved to inpatient units or urgent care centers to manage the surge. So people that are less suited and trained and used to working in higher level care, hospital care, and particularly critical care, are being moved in to try to cover the huge surge that we have. And in ICU care, that is critical care, it's important to know that a bed is not a bed is not a bed. What really happens on the ground that's going to drive death rates is, in fact, the level of care that's even possible for any given bed. So if you have a respiratory therapist who's normally taking care of a couple patients, if they're taking care of three or four or five or six, and similarly you're moving less trained people into highly critical care situations, you're not going to get as good a care and you're going to see worse outcomes. So even the hospitalizations, it's going to be difficult to really use that as an indicator in how much it's going to drive deaths because we're starting to cap out. And of course, a lot of the stats you'll see will be for an entire state or the entire nation. But of course, we got thousands of hospitals in this country. Some are going to do okay. A lot are going to do very, very poorly. And those may very well be the drivers for very high death rates. Okay, well, the Biden administration announced this last week again that they're surging U.S. military medical personnel, deploying them to hospitals that are struggling with staff shortages amid the soaring COVID-19 cases. It's interesting to note they're talking like 1,000 people. Well, we have almost 10 million highly trained healthcare workers and have lost about 150,000 of them due to what I was talking earlier about, lost by stress, moral injury, and the great resignation. So throwing 1,000 in there, if you well place them, will do a tad bit of good. It is better than nothing, but better than nothing is very far from passing. Okay, well, I'd like to move on to what has become in the last several weeks my major pet peeve. Here's a quote from an article. This actually is the title. Breakthrough COVID cases overwhelmingly mild for vaccinated people. Even just wrap your head around that notion. Overwhelmingly mild. Pfft, wow. I would nominate taking mild out of the dictionary for a few weeks. It would probably do us better. Okay, well, I want to take a quote also for related to this mild fixation for Omicron, thinking that's a lot less mild than the Delta variant. Here's a quote from an LA Times article. Dr. Paul Simon, chief science officer for the LA County Department of Public Health, said, "We have over 4,000 patients in the hospital with COVID. We think about maybe 40% of them are hospitalized for other reasons, but they happen to test positive for COVID upon admission." Just happen to. While not new, questions surrounding incidental coronavirus admissions have become a particular interest in the Omicron age as officials try to quantify the variant severity compared with Delta. Nationwide, COVID-19 hospitalizations have surged to levels surpassing even the harrowing heights seen during last winter's wave. Dr. Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute in La Jolla, said he thinks, "We have this maybe warped view about how mild or milder Omicron is when it clearly can kill and put a lot of people in the hospital. Too many people have tried to minimize the hospitalizations, and I think we are grossly overestimating the with rather than the for COVID," he said in an online discussion last Thursday with Dr. Robert Wachner, the chair of the UC San Francisco's Department of Medicine. So one way to look at this is even if you have active infection in, say, 4% of your population, say the Southern California population that he's talking about, but this is compared to about 40% of people that are actually infected within the hospitals, that means the people in the hospital, lo and behold, just happen to have a tenfold risk for hospitalization if you have COVID. Now, this is a very, very difficult thing to explain away as something other than COVID driving these hospitalizations. And we already know that COVID creates viremia, meaning gets in the blood and not just attack one tissue like the lungs, but can attack the brain and the kidneys and the heart and other tissues and creates a whole lot of problem. So if you have a lot of people with a lot of comorbidities, underlying conditions, and they happen to get COVID, even though you may not get a lot of the traditional COVID like respiratory symptoms, it can actually push your health to the point where you need hospitalization. This, I think, is by far the best explanation for why you would see something on the order of a tenfold risk of hospitalizations for people that, quote, happen to have COVID. This kind of minimalization does not do us any good. Naive optimism is not a strategy. Okay, well, the study in the last week that broke through and made all the news was this study, as reported by Medical Express. Reduce hospitalization risk, shorter stays for Omicron patients, says U.S. study. A preliminary U.S. study of nearly 70,000 COVID-positive people showed a substantially reduced risk of hospitalization and death from Omicron, even after controlling for growing population immunity levels. People infected with Omicron were half as likely to be hospitalized, about 75% less likely to need intensive care, and around 90% less likely to die compared to those infected with the formerly dominant Delta variant, according to the paper. The new paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed or published, was carried out by researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, Kaiser Permanente, and the CDC. This study controlled for important key parameters such as age, sex, prior SARS-CoV-2 infection, prior vaccination, and comorbidities, said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky on a briefing call last Wednesday. Yikes. Well, you know what? I wish this was true. But honestly, I really did a deep dive into this preliminary report, and I'd have to say I'll give them an A-plus for trying, but this is really, seriously, an impossible study to do. They were trying to measure outcomes that take weeks crammed into a one-month study. That is, they were trying to measure COVID hospitalizations, ICU admissions, being put on a ventilator, and dying. These things from the point of infection generally take weeks, sometimes 6 or 7 weeks. Almost all of the Omicron patients tested positive in the last 10 days of the study. So how much hospitalization, ICU admissions, putting on a ventilator, and dying are you going to see in the last week of the month study? And this allowed extremely little time to get any accurate look at such outcomes. So it's an epic try with very sketchy results. So like I said, I did a deep dive into this preliminary report, read the whole thing, and I would say the researchers did their best with an impossible situation, but their conclusions and the use of these conclusions by the CDC director and the media covering the story were misleading at best. Okay, so the raw numbers of severe outcomes they were trying to measure were too small, that is the raw numbers, to make their main conclusion statistically valid. They didn't lie, but they framed the results with a far greater level of confidence than normally applied to scientific studies. We still don't have good evidence that Omicron is substantially less severe than Delta. This is important research, and hopefully with a longer-term follow-up allowed, we can get more reliable and valid results. Now, another way to present this data would be the probabilities of symptomatic hospitalization or ICU admission were not statistically significantly different for Delta and Omicron at 14 days after testing positive. The number of events of mechanical ventilation and deaths were too low for statistical comparison. So at 14 days, there was no statistically significant difference in symptomatic hospitalizations or ICU admission between Delta and Omicron. That typically would be the finding that you'd have in a scientific study. They look for statistical significance, not just a raw number difference. And when you're dealing with small numbers of severe outcomes, that makes a huge difference. So this is a way over reading into these results. Okay, well, there is one characteristic of Omicron that is well validated from other studies, and that is that Omicron is about 3 times more transmissible than Delta. This research did not have the power to even revalidate that. This, in fact, did not show up in their study. Okay, I'm going to get a little technical here, but this is what it literally says in their research paper. Quote, in this analysis, prevalence of prior vaccination differed among cases with Omicron and Delta variant infections. While our analysis cannot infer absolute vaccine effectiveness against the distinct variants, our findings suggest vaccine protection against infection with the Omicron variant may be lower than protection against infection with the Delta variant. End of quote. So that's kind of hard to understand, but it's really a nice way of saying that they detected no statistically significant difference in vaccine protection against infection between Delta and Omicron. So this is something that's already been validated in other studies and is widely accepted in the scientific community. And this study did not have the power to actually even identify that there was a difference in vaccine protection from infection between Delta and Omicron. So I'm not holding up a whole lot of validity. I am holding out that if they get another month's worth of data, we'll get some really good data out of this population. But of course, the other thing is generalizability in studies, meaning that you take a specific study population and you have to make an inference of how well it applies to the broader, larger population. And we know that the Kaiser Permanente folks in Southern California are not necessarily representative of all people in California, let alone Southern California, and that people in California, lo and behold, are not necessarily representative of people in the U.S. as a whole, particularly smaller states, rural areas. Okay, well, one way to avoid statistical problems is actually measure the entire sample. You can look at an entire country and look at their vaccination rates and look at how many people in their ICU, and you can make some startling conclusions. We have from Germany, this from Medical Express. Majority of COVID patients in German ICUs not vaccinated. Of course, that's the headline, but if you read it, it says, the data from Germany's Intensive Care Association shows that 62% of ICU patients whose vaccine status was known had received no protective shots against the coronavirus. Unvaccinated people make up about 1/4 of the German population. Almost 10% were only partially vaccinated, while 28% of ICU patients were fully inoculated, it said. About 72% of the German population has received at least two jabs, what we consider fully vaccinated, while 45% have also had a booster shot, and that's about double the U.S. So there's more people that are fully vaccinated in Germany, and there's almost double the amount of people that have received a booster shot, 45% of the total population compared to like 24% here in the U.S. So the reality on the ground is that there are plenty of vaccinated folks that are ending up in the ICU, hardly mild. Don't call that a mild case if you end up in the ICU. So again, to look at that, if you have 72% of the German population that's been fully vaccinated, they're still accounting for 28% of the ICU patients. Yikes. So of course, that's less than being unvaccinated, but that is far from low risk, and with so many infections, going to create a lot of very serious disease. Okay, well, let's bring it home. Let's look what's happening on the ground in LA, which is Southern California, where this study was actually conducted. So what's actually happening in the real world outside of that study? This from the LA Times. Emergency rooms nearing crisis levels in parts of California as Omicron surges. Emergency rooms are nearing crisis levels in parts of California, and officials are forecasting weeks of strain in hospitals, even as there are glimmers of hope the Omicron wave may soon peak in the northern part of the state. There is unprecedented spread of the coronavirus in California. Never before in a pandemic have so many people been simultaneously infected. And despite signs that Omicron is less likely to require patients to need mechanical help to breathe, the extraordinarily high case rate, 2.5 times last winter's peak, is still leaving hospitals so inundated that scheduled surgeries are being canceled and ambulances are facing long delays dropping off patients. We are seeing near crisis levels of emergency department overcrowding in certain areas, said Dr. Eric Pan, the state epidemiologist. By midweek, California was reporting 52,400 hospitalizations for all reasons, just shy of the peak of 53,000 recorded at the height of last winter's surge. LA County was also approaching its peak. Last Thursday, it had 15,000 people hospitalized for all reasons, approaching the pandemic high of nearly 16,500 set last winter, when most hospitals were frankly overwhelmed, said County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer. Overall demand for emergency care is causing a huge stress in our emergency rooms. With healthcare staffing shortages on the inpatient ward, it's harder to admit patients. And if you don't have enough nurses to take care of those patients, then there's a backlog in the emergency department as well. That then results in ambulances kept waiting in front of hospitals, delaying crews' ability to respond to new 911 calls. Hospitals are full, said Dr. Regino Kwong, a deputy health officer for Orange County, where many ambulances are waiting as long as 44 minutes to drop off patients once they arrive in emergency rooms, which is above the goal of 30 minutes. Last week, about 5 of Orange County's 25 hospitals were requesting more staffing from the state to help fill gaps. Now, more than half of our hospitals are experiencing significant staffing shortages and have also asked for assistance. The Los Angeles County emergency medical system is so challenged that the county has dispatched workers to monitor patients in emergency rooms so ambulances can be released faster to reduce worsening 911 response times. Demand for hospital care is so great that LA County and the state have established 3 surge hospital units. When fully staffed, they will add nearly 100 beds to LA County, including 33 intensive care unit beds. So that's good, but again, a very small percentage proportional addition to their capacity. The coming weeks will be a bad time to be hospitalized, said UC San Francisco infectious disease expert Dr. Peter Chin Hong, when California will be probably already in the middle of being bursted at the seams for increased hospitalization. Worsening matters is a national scarcity of donated blood. A blood shortage forced an hours-long closure of the trauma center at Harbor UCLA Medical Center last Monday, a step not taken there in more than 3 decades. COVID-19 patients are constituting an increasing share of LA County's intensive care unit patients, nearly 25%, up from 10% around Christmas. About 20% of ventilated patients have COVID-19, an increase from 10% last month. Los Angeles County health officials are urging residents to postpone non-essential gatherings and avoid some activities, especially with people who are unmasked, unvaccinated, or at higher risk of severe illness. Nationwide, COVID-19 hospitalizations have surged to levels surpassing even the harrowing heights seen during last winter's wave. Okay, well, and another story from the severity front. This from Medical Express. For people over 50, even, quote, mild COVID-19 can result in mobility problems. Adults over age 50 who experience mild or moderate COVID-19 are at greater risk of worsening mobility and physical function, even if hospitalization is not required to treat the virus, according to new research. Individuals with confirmed or probable COVID-19 had double the odds of worsening ability to engage in household activities and participate in physical activity than those without COVID-19. Similar results were found for those with suspected COVID-19. Yet another long-term effect of COVID-19, even amidst the so-called mild cases. Well, folks, this article definitely reminds us of the fact that COVID is a pernicious disease and that it caused a lot of chronic cumulative tissue damage. This leads to long COVID, these disability efforts. And you hear some talk, you know, people trying to find silver linings amidst this Omicron hurricane here about, quote, moving towards endemicity. In other words, endemic, when you just have a steadier kind of lower level of infections. And I've even heard so-called experts really talk about it like the cold or the flu. I hope so. I wish. But I don't think it's actually realistic to think that COVID-19 is going to be any less serious than the flu, and likely it'll be multiples of time more serious for the foreseeable future, perhaps years, maybe forever, pretty much. And that's because this is a different beast. And even if we are able to get some level of herd immunity, I don't even like that, just more population immunity, it's the same like with cold viruses and the flu. You still get them, you get reinfected, and you have them. And if you just look at the severity of colds and flus and COVID, probably the proportion that they've had with people who have some immunity is probably going to be a relative indicator of what's going to happen in the long-term future. And that means that even people that have had previous infection and even multiple vaccinations can still have some pretty serious risk of disease, and that's even for mild cases in the long run. Okay, well, we took a big hit as a nation in the long run as the Supreme Court halts COVID-19 vaccine rule for U.S. businesses. This from Stat News. The Supreme Court has stopped the Biden administration from enforcing a requirement that employees at large businesses be vaccinated against COVID-19 or undergo weekly tests and wear a mask on the job. So this basically takes off the table a way to get tens and tens and tens of people who have not been vaccinated, vaccinated. So I'm not going to say much about it, except I'm going to give a little ditty about the dissenting judges. In dissent, the court's three liberals argued that it was the court that was overreaching by substituting its judgment for that of health experts. Quote, acting outside of its competence and without legal basis, the court displaces the judgment of the government officials given the responsibility to respond to workplace health emergencies, end of quote. Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor wrote in a joint dissent. I find that quite taxing. Okay, well, as I've reported the last couple of weeks too, a lot on about trust in science or government affecting vaccine acceptance. And here's another good addition to that from Medical Express. Trust in science at root of vaccine acceptance. Results of a global research project by the University of Rochester Medical Center indicate that trust in science is the most powerful determinant of whether a person will decide to get a COVID vaccine. One of the key objectives was to understand the association between vaccine acceptance or hesitancy and trust in institutions, that is science, government, and healthcare, and how these would play roles in convincing the public to get vaccinated. The study found that trust in science, namely the ability of biomedical research to produce a safe and effective vaccine, had the most impact on the decision to get vaccinated. They also found vaccine acceptance was higher in younger ages, under 32 years old, and those with more education. Further, people indicating they were unlikely to obtain a COVID vaccine were also less likely to socially distance or to stay home from school or work and reported lower social support from friends, families, and significant others. The science trust gap has many potential sources, according to the authors. Scientific literacy plays an important role. The conduct of science inherently takes time, can generate a range of findings, and studies often have limitations based on their scope and methodology, factors that make it vulnerable to conspiracy theories and misrepresentations. Science-informed policy is also vulnerable to politicization, and in many communities there is historic mistrust of science due to past abuses. Okay, so I think what this added to my previous reporting is that it really compared side by side the trust in science, the trust in government, and the trust in healthcare. And the least related to government trust or belief in effectiveness of government, the willingness to get a vaccine was least related to government trust or belief in the effectiveness of government. And it was more related to belief in the effectiveness of healthcare, but the most related to the belief in the effectiveness of the biomedical sciences. Yes, folks, trusting in science. It's a tough thing. I hope in my show here that I can develop a trust between you and my listeners, that I am taking a critical eye at science and knowing the weaknesses and reporting to you, and you can make your own judgments. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up, under quirky policy in COVID in the U.S., this from Medical Express. Americans should avoid travel to Canada, says CDC. Americans should avoid travel to Canada due to, quote, very high levels of COVID-19 cases in that country, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said last Monday. The agency placed Canada under a level 4 travel health notice, which is the highest category and indicates other countries and includes other countries such as France, Germany, Britain, Spain, and South Africa. Because of the current situation in Canada, even fully vaccinated travelers may be at risk for getting and spreading COVID variants, the CDC said in a statement. Oh, well, of course, their rate is actually less than the United States, so it's so funny. We're telling people not to go to a country that actually you'd be safer in Canada than you would be here. Maybe we should tell people to go to Canada. Oh, man. So Americans who must travel to Canada should be fully vaccinated, the CDC advised. Fully vaccinated people are allowed to enter Canada, but must be tested beforehand. The Canadians want to be a little careful about letting Americans. That's the way it should be, rather than Americans not wanting to go to a place that actually has a lot of COVID, but actually less than what we have here. But there's all kinds of compromises made in this pandemic. Here's another one from Medical Express. Health officials let COVID-infected staff stay on the job. Health authorities around the U.S. are increasingly taking the extraordinary step of allowing nurses and other workers infected with the coronavirus to stay on the job if they have mild symptoms or none at all. The move is a reaction to the severe hospital staffing shortages and crushing caseloads that the Omicron variant is causing. California health authorities announced over the weekend that hospital staff members who test positive but are symptom-free can continue working. Some hospitals in Rhode Island and Arizona have likewise told employees they can stay on the job if they have no symptoms or just mild ones. Many hospitals are not only swamped with cases, but severely shorthanded because so many employees are out with COVID-19. The 100,000-member California Nurses Association came out against the decision and warned it will lead to more infections. Governor Gavin Newsom and other state health leaders, quote, are putting the needs of healthcare corporations before the safety of patients and workers, Kathy Kennedy, the association's president, said in a statement. We want to care for our patients and see them get better, not potentially infect them. Oh, and the continuing saga of testing and quarantine, this also from Medical Express. 1 in 10 people may still be infectious for COVID after 10 days, new research indicates. 1 in 10 people may have clinically relevant levels of potentially infectious SARS-CoV-2 past the 10-day quarantine period, according to the new research. And of course, the new quarantine period is 5 days. The study, published in the International Journal of Infectious Diseases, found that 13% of people still exhibited clinically relevant levels of virus after 10 days, meaning they could potentially still be infectious. Some people retained these levels for up to 68 days. The authors believe this new test should be applied in settings where people are vulnerable to stop the spread of COVID-19. Conventional PCR tests work by testing for the presence of viral fragments. While they can tell if someone has recently had the virus, they cannot detect whether it is still active and the person is infectious. The test used in this latest research study, however, gives a positive result only when the virus is active and potentially capable of onward transmission. Lead author Merlin Davies of the University of Exeter Medical School said, in some settings, such as people returning to nursing homes from illness, people continuing to be infectious after 10 days could pose a serious public health risk. We may need to ensure people in those settings have a negative active virus test to ensure people are no longer infectious. And in related news, also for Medical Express, viral load of Omicron can be at its highest at day 5, so cutting isolation period doesn't make sense. Let us consider the scientific justification for the recommended isolation periods. A comprehensive UK-based systematic review of 79 papers from around the world, excluding those countries with very low case numbers, that reviewed viral shedding of over 5,000 infected people, evaluated not only the viral load determined by PCR testing, which can remain positive for some time beyond clinical recovery, but also looked at the ability to cultivate viable virus from these people, and so clearly demonstrating infectiousness. The review showed a low viral load in the first couple of days, but then a peak around days 3 to 6, tailing off days 7 to 9 until no viable virus could be recovered by day 10. In other words, the data supported a 10-day isolation period. A few studies have suggested a slightly shorter period of viral shedding in people with no symptoms, but decisions on national policy should not be based on all infections, must be based on all infections, not just a subset. A more recent study from Japan looked at viral shedding attributed to Omicron. The study reflected the findings of the systemic review, showing that viral shedding is highest at 3 to 6 days after the start of symptoms. And a small study from the University of Exeter, the one I referenced earlier, found that 1 in 3 people are still potentially infectious after 5 days. The evidence suggests that at day 5, many people will still be shedding viable virus, potentially resulting in considerable onward COVID spread. So what evidence is the government using on which these recent reductions to isolation periods are based? Following the science? Perhaps not.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, our national testing strategy is pretty much failing, but the feds are trying to come to the rescue. This from Medical Express. Website for free virus test is coming. How will it work? How can I request a free test? Starting Wednesday, January 19th, free tests can be ordered at covidtest.gov. That's covidtest.gov. The first test will ship by the end of January. The White House says tests will typically ship within 7 to 12 days of ordering through the U.S. Postal Service. I'm sorry, I run a mail order business, and that is crappy turnaround, 7 to 12 days of ordering. Yikes. Importantly, given the shipping and processing times, Americans will need to request the test well before they meet federal guidelines for requiring a test, so think ahead. How many tests can I order from the website? The White House says that, to quote, to promote broad access, shipments from covidtest.gov will initially be limited to 4 rapid tests per residential address, no matter the number of occupants. Is there another way to get a test kit for free? Starting last Saturday, private insurers were required to cover the cost of up to 8 at-home rapid tests per month per insured person, according to the new Biden administration rule. Of course, this is people with private insurance. People have the option of buying tests at a store or online, then seeking reimbursement from their health insurance providers. Insurers are being incentivized to work with pharmacies and retailers to develop plans to cover the cost of the test with no out-of-pocket cost to customers. But those programs will not be immediately widespread. Whew, that might be the understatement of the day. Those with public health insurance through Medicare or without insurance will be directed to covidtest.gov to order tests or to community health centers in the area offering free testing. Well, I'm really curious to see how this plays out. I don't know about you, but I'd be very, very, very reluctant to try to get reimbursed. What a nightmare. That could take months, and I doubt if you'll get paid minimum wage in the amount of time it'll take you in the average person to get reimbursed for that test kit. And in a little testing news from the state of Ohio, this from the State House News Bureau, Ohio changes priorities for distribution of COVID tests from libraries to schools. The Ohio Department of Health says it will divert incoming rapid COVID test kits to K-12 schools, colleges, and universities. If you are waiting for your local library or health department to get more rapid COVID tests in stock, you might be waiting a while longer. The Ohio Department of Health says it's changing its priorities and will be diverting incoming stocks to K-12 schools, colleges, and universities. The state's health department says it had previously ordered 1.2 million antigen tests to be distributed free of charge through libraries and health departments in the month of January, but so far only 400,000 of those have been distributed. The Ohio Department of Health says shipments of the remaining 800,000 ordered test kits have been put on hold by the manufacturer as demand for them has increased nationwide. The Ohio Department of Health expects to receive shipments later this month, but says when they arrive, they will be given to schools, not libraries and health departments. The health department says the antigen tests are a critical tool to help ensure in-person learning can continue in Ohio schools, so it's important that they have access to these tests and make sure kids and teachers can stay in class. Like in the overall community, demand for COVID-19 tests in schools continues to climb. In recent days, there have been mass testing sites opened in various cities throughout the state where Ohioans can get PCR tests performed by the medical professional. ODH says once schools have what they need, the state will once again send test kits to libraries and health departments. Well, you can go to lucascountyhealth.org, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department site, and get information about those PCR tests that are available locally in a couple different sites. But I would warn you, while they say you can get your results in 72 hours, that's not what I'm hearing. Okay, well, one more odds and ends to report on before I get to the local COVID update. I haven't reported on prisons for a while. But right now, if you go to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, that's not most people. Most people are in state prisons. But in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, first of all, they don't do very much testing. And they're all time, from the beginning of the pandemic, their testing positivity rate is 37.4%. That is terrible. That is a failed testing program. But currently, with that terrible testing program, they have identified right now 4.5% of the federal prison population has been currently identified as HIV. And I'm sorry, COVID-19 positive. Yep, it's going to be hard to avoid it when you're in that kind of institutional setting. Okay, well, let's do the Lucas County COVID-19 update. The average daily number of cases stayed about the same. It went up to 916 from 903 last week, but our testing has been jammed up. Local testing positivity rate is 27.9%. The CDC tends to just say over 25%. When you start getting to that level, just basically means your testing system is broken. And the Ohio positivity rate is 29.8%. And the U.S. rate is 28.2%. In Ohio, the volume of testing has actually went down after a pretty big spike. It's still higher than it was during the peak of the Delta surge this fall in Lucas County, but it's down from the peak of the week before. There has been a very large, unprecedented spike in testing in the country as a whole, jumped up about 50% in the last week. So we got a lot more testing, but still getting a 28.2% positivity rate. Yikes. Okay, nursing homes. Well, we're starting to see a lot more cases. The good news I'll give first is we didn't have any more reported deaths from nursing homes, but we moved up to 136 active cases from 103 the previous week. That's 55 residents and 81 staff. So the bigger increase was actually among residents rather than staff. So this might not be a good sign of things to come. Okay, well, in Lucas County schools, there was actually no reporting in Lucas County. There was some reporting in other counties in Ohio, but not in Lucas County, kind of showing that their system is kind of broken. I mean, we have some schools that are closed down, so they're not even doing testing, but probably the people that are doing reporting are probably out with COVID too. Who knows? But we didn't have any reporting, so I can't report on that. But if you look at nationally, at the top 500 largest school districts in the country, over a third of them actually have no mask requirements. So it tells you like how well we're set up in schools to deal with Omicron. Not very well. And if you look at UT, the University of Toledo, they're back online doing their surveillance testing back in school. And they have a record number of cases reported. They had 144 identified cases. But of course, that's just the cases that are identified. And most of those were people who had symptoms and they got tested on campus. Some got just tested at community test sites. But the real kicker is their surveillance testing. And this is a really important indicator, particularly for that age group of college age, because this is one of the few things where we're actually doing random testing in the community. So they're randomly testing students, UT students. They had 26 positives, which was 14% of those that were tested. And that's a smaller number that they tested because they just got back to school. But 14%, that cracks any previous record, both in the absolute number and the percentage of people that were identified. So even though they have a vaccine requirement and the vast majority of students are fully vaccinated, you're still seeing COVID rage in the University of Toledo community. Okay, well, Lucas County hospitalizations continue to set new records. Ohio hospitals do seem to have leveled off. Not sure exactly what to make of that. I mean, I was talking earlier about the fact that, we've been stressed out in Ohio for actually going on months now, and Lucas County similarly. But you got to wonder if we're kind of maxing our capacity, you know, where we're getting to the point where you can't really have more. And people are making, physicians are making different decisions about, moving people into the hospital, admitting them, or moving them up to ICUs. Things change when you're in crisis mode. Okay, well, I guess the ultimate stat in public health, and probably the easiest one to notice and keep track of, is death. Okay, well, COVID-19 deaths have risen to about 2,000 per day over a 7-day average. The most recent days are actually higher than that, so we'll see where that goes. You can expect that to go up. But again, like I said at the beginning of the show, that puts us solidly into COVID-19 as the number one killer in the country. Lucas County death rate is higher than the Ohio rate, and it's over 2 times higher than that of the national rate, although that's going up fast as well as it sweeps across the country. Okay, well, not a whole lot of news in vaccinations. We're still creeping up similar as we've done before, playing the long game, hopefully to get more people vaccinated. boosters nationwide. We've gotten up to 24% of the total population that's received boosters. That's a slightly higher, a couple percent higher actually in Ohio. So we're doing a pretty good job of boosting, although we're doing a little less good job of the number of people that have actually gotten fully vaccinated. But in total, you got about a quarter of the United States population that has been boosted. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, maybe we can get to a few non-COVID-19 stories. This from the Public News Service. Healthcare disparities, a way of life for Black Ohioans? A new report suggests discrimination in medical settings affects the quality of care for many Ohioans. In a survey of more than 800 people, discrimination was not a rare experience, and for women and people of color, it was common. In the survey, Black women reported feeling less respected twice as often as white men, and Black men were four times more likely to report being harassed in a healthcare setting. Some 22% of those surveyed said they have accepted discrimination in medical settings, quote, as a way of life. But 24% said they did not return for future appointments, which may mean delaying or avoiding needed health care. Just 15% of people who said they felt discriminated against went on to file a complaint. The report noted many hospital systems have equity training, but few have anti-racism initiatives. Dawn Pullen, Director of Behavioral Health and Addictions for the Northeast Ohio Black Health Coalition, contended such efforts only scratch the surface of the problem. That training that we've done over the past 20 or 30 years has brought us to this place where the survey is still necessary, where health is still a crisis, Pullen asserted, where Black and African American people are dying daily because of the lack of services and their skepticism about engaging the hospital setting. Pierrette Talley, Executive Director of the Ohio Unity Coalition, believes hospitals and other healthcare institutions have made a good start toward addressing racism, but she said they need to dig deeper than community forums, health fairs, and government-required anti-discrimination measures. They must be in touch with the community that they serve and work together to figure out what are the issues and how they can best be addressed, Talley urged, so that we are rooting out racism at an institutional level and not just looking at some bad actors. Well, folks, in this case, if something, including accepting discrimination in medical settings, is a way of life, this is, in fact, a way of death. Not good news for a healthcare system, which should be a center of healing. Okay, well, another story that's interesting, particularly since infectious disease is something that's becoming more and more pronounced in our understanding of public health in this country. This from Stat News. Strong new evidence suggests a virus triggers multiple sclerosis. Now researchers have found strong evidence that it's an infection, specifically the Epstein-Barr virus, best known for causing mononucleosis. In a large cohort of military service members followed for many years, infection with Epstein-Barr increased the likelihood of developing multiple sclerosis, or MS, by more than 32-fold, a team of scientists led by Harvard University's Neuroepidemiology Research Group reported in the journal Science. Our data strongly suggests Epstein-Barr virus is the leading cause of multiple sclerosis, said Kjetil Bjørnevik, a research scientist at Harvard and the study's lead author. It was a really dramatic increase in risk that would be very hard to explain any other way. Epstein-Barr virus is a virus, so our immune systems can be trained to prevent it from infecting us. Currently, there is no vaccine against Epstein-Barr. Efforts to develop one have historically been hindered by technical hurdles and lack of investment because the virus isn't initially life-threatening. But studies like this suggest we should be pushing harder on developing a vaccine against Epstein-Barr. Besides MS, the virus has also been linked to a variety of cancers and other autoimmune diseases such as lupus. If the Epstein-Barr virus is causing MS, then this should shift the focus of research into trying to find a cure for MS, as well as motivate vaccine development, said Bjørnevik. The study might also shift research priorities for other neurological conditions. For years, scientists have found evidence that Alzheimer's disease might be driven by inflammation triggered by viral infections, including other herpes viruses. But these outsiders' research has repeatedly been met with ridicule, their projects left unfunded, and their hypotheses unexplored. Our findings are very specific for MS, but we expect it may spark interest in re-examining infectious causes of other diseases, said Bjørnevik. Okay, I want to do a couple quick updates to the Aduhelm story. That's that new drug that was approved for Alzheimer's. We have some movement, some happenings with that. This from Medical Express. Medicare proposes to only cover Alzheimer's drug Aduhelm for use in clinical trials. It's a move that could severely limit the number of people taking the controversial new Alzheimer's drug Aduhelm. Medicare proposed to only cover the cost of the pricey medication for people enrolled in approved clinical trials. A final decision on coverage is expected later this year. And because of that, this from Medical Express. Medicare told to reassess premium hike for Alzheimer's drug. U.S. Health Secretary Xavier Becerra ordered Medicare to reassess a big premium increase facing millions of enrollees this year, attributing a large start to a pricey new Alzheimer's drug with questionable benefits. His directive came days after biomaker Biogen slashed the price of its $56,000 a year medication, Aduhelm, to $28,200 a year, a cut of about half. Well, that's darn cheap. Only $28,000 a year for the drug, not for the infusions to take it. Yikes. With the 50% price drop of Aduhelm on January 1st, there is a compelling basis to re-examine the previous recommendation, Becerra said. More than 50 million Medicare recipients who pay the $170.10 monthly Part B premium for outpatient care will see no immediate change in their costs, but this move could open the way for reduction later in the year. The Department of Health and Human Services says it is reaching out to the Social Security Administration, which collects a premium, to examine options. Medicare standard premium is rising by about $22 this year, up from $148.50 in 2021, and one of the biggest annual increases ever. About half of that, $11 a month, was attributed to the potential cost of having to cover Aduhelm alone at its original $56,000 price. Since Aduhelm is administered by infusion in a doctor's office, the cost is factored into Medicare's outpatient coverage, not the separate prescription plan that pays for pharmacy medicines. I am very glad to see the brakes being put on Aduhelm. Let's study it. If it does happen to work, well, then let's move with it. But it's very sketchy at this point. Okay, let's do a couple chronic disease stories, and then we'll move on to some last story of some better news. Okay, first up, this from Science Daily. Long-term use of blood pressure drugs may cause kidney damage, study suggests. New kidney research from the University of Virginia School of Medicine is raising concerns that long-term use of drugs commonly prescribed to treat high blood pressure and heart failure could be contributing to kidney damage. The researchers found long-term use of drugs that inhibit the renin angiotensin system, such as ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, have a similar effect. These drugs are widely used for many purposes, including treating high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, and heart attacks, as well as to prevent major heart problems. But long-term use of the drugs was associated with hardened kidney vessels in both lab mice and humans, the scientists found. The researchers note that the medications can be life-saving for patients, so they stress the importance of continuing to take them. But they say additional studies are needed to better understand the drug's long-term effects on the kidneys. Now, I think this one's really important because I think a hugely underreported chronic health problem is kidney disease. You've got at least 10% of the U.S. population that has kidney disease. It's a severe problem, and most people aren't that aware of it. And if something even more common, like high blood pressure, which is really common, you've got the majority of people that are seniors that have high blood pressure, and a lot of them are taking this particular drug, this could be very important for the population as a whole in driving kidney disease. So something to keep an eye on. Okay, next up from Conscien Health. Why are we failing on diabetes health risks? The numbers are stark. More than 80% of Americans with diabetes are not meeting clinical targets to reduce heart disease risk. For people with both diabetes and obesity, more than 90% are bearing unnecessary risk. These numbers come from a new scientific statement in Circulation from the American Heart Association. On top of those numbers is the magnitude of global diabetes, 537 million people worldwide. It is a global pandemic spiraling out of control, says Professor Andrew Bolton, president of the International Diabetes Federation. Clearly, we are failing on diabetes health risks. As to the question of why, the answer lies, at least in part, with how poorly health systems and policymakers are dealing with obesity. Abundant research tells us how to prevent diabetes and manage its risks. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has straightforward, evidence-based guidelines for pre-diabetes screening, but a recent study shows that vanishingly few patients actually get that screening. AMA reports that this is one of the biggest missed opportunities in medicine. It all points to a disconnect between the philosophy of the profession and the structure of our healthcare system. On the one hand, the mission of medicine is to keep people healthy, to prevent suffering. But in the current payment system, prevention just isn't the top priority. It's nice to hear that from the AMA. The U.S. healthcare system, for the most part, only encourages quality care once people are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Decades ago, the Diabetes Prevention Program proved that behavioral support for weight management prevents diabetes. It's an element of the Preventive Service Task Force guidance, but health systems, including Medicare, are structured to give little more than lip service. The Center for Medicaid Services has consistently dragged its feet on efforts for diabetes. A new paper in JAMA Surgery tells us that gastric bypass enables 3/4 of patients to discontinue their diabetes medications after surgery. After 5 years, most of them, 70%, still have no needs for those meds. In fact, bariatric surgery is the most effective way by far to put diabetes into remission for people with both diabetes and obesity. Yet health systems throw up endless barriers to accessing effective obesity care. So the failure on diabetes health risk should be no surprise. This is a classic case of neglecting a slow-burning fire until it becomes an overwhelming catastrophe. We're smarter than this. Our health system needs to wise up. Well, there's no question that we're smart. The question is, how wise are we? Much tougher to be wise than smart. That includes having courage. Okay, well, I want to end on a completely different story. There's some good news from Science Daily. Swapping just one food item per day can make diet substantially more planet-friendly. If your New Year's resolution is to eat better for the planet, a new Tulane University study finds it may be easier than you think. Americans who eat beef could slash their diet's carbon footprint as much as 48% by swapping just one serving per day for a more planet-friendly alternative, according to a new study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Using real-world data from a survey of more than 16,000 Americans eat in an average day, researchers from Tulane University School of Public Health and the University of Michigan calculated how much a difference people could make if they swapped one high-impact food item for a similar, more sustainable option. They examined how the change would impact two metrics, their daily diet's greenhouse gas emissions and their water scarcity footprint, a measure of the irrigated water used to produce the foods they eat and take into account regional variations in water scarcity. The highest impact item on Americans' diet is beef, and around 20% of survey respondents ate at least one serving of it in a day. If they collectively swapped one serving of beef, for example, choosing ground turkey instead of ground beef, their diet's greenhouse gas emissions fell by an average of 48%, and water use impact declined by 30%. People can make a significant difference in their carbon footprint with very simple changes, and the easiest one would be to substitute poultry for beef, said lead author Diego Rose, professor of nutrition and food security at Tulane University School of Public Health. The study also examined how the change would affect the overall environmental impact of all food consumption in the U.S. in a day, including the 80% of diets without any changes. If only the 20% of Americans who ate beef in a day switched for something else for one meal, that would reduce the overall carbon footprint of all U.S. diets by about 10% and reduce water use impacts by 6%. Although swapping beef had the greatest impact, they also measured the impact of changing other items. Replacing a serving of shrimp with cod reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 34%. Replacing dairy milk with soy milk resulted in an 8% reduction. The greatest reduction in the water scarcity footprint came from replacing asparagus with peas, resulting in a 48% decrease. Substituting peanuts in place of almonds decreased the water scarcity footprint by 30%. Although individual substitutions were the focus of the study, Rose said that addressing climate change must involve more than singular actions. The changes needed to address our climate problems are major. They're needed across all sectors, along all levels of human organization, from international agencies to federal and state governments to communities and households, Rose said. Many individuals feel strongly about this and wish to change our climate problem through direct actions that they control. This, in turn, can change social norms about both the seriousness of the problem and the potential solutions that can address it. Our study provides evidence that even simple steps can assist in these efforts. Okay, so go to it, people. Okay, I want to close with the bonus articles that are available online, as are all the other articles that I've talked about in this show. 14 articles, a big one this week, and I'll give you the link at the end. 1, a cascade of Omicron-driven shortages puts U.S. hospitals in a bind. 2, You'd expect healthcare workers on the COVID front lines to be tested regularly. You'd be wrong. 3. Open source vaccines got more funding from Tito's Vodka than the government. 4. Is it flu, COVID-19, allergies, or a cold? Good practical information in this viral blizzard. 5. Well, these next two are a couple articles about masks that if you're interested in that, this is very good. So 5 is why we need to wear better masks, and 6 is how long can I keep using the same N95 respirator mask? 7, feeling powerless in the pandemic? 4, self-determination principles can help you take back some control. 8, politics still make people sick. 9, the movie Don't Look Up illustrates 5 myths that fuel rejection of science. 10, public health is missing crucial data from LGBTQIA+ people. It's not hard to collect. 11. The American Medical Association's new language guide is a step towards health equity. 12. Partial removal of lead water service lines can actually increase lead risks. 13. The soldiers came home sick. The government denied it was responsible. The military's garbage disposal fires in war zones made them ill. And 14. New report reveals Kroger grocery workers struggle to afford healthy food. One of the most ironic things in the world is that people around the planet who grow food are actually the most likely to be food insecure. And here in the United States, one of our largest employers in this country is Kroger's. And these grocery workers are struggling to afford healthy food, even though surrounded by it all their workday. Sad. Well, you can read this and other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.